Blog Talk Radio.
This is Blog Talk Radio, and I'm Marcia Joyner, host of Betrayed by Hospice. Thank you to our producer, Marty Oakley, for affording us the opportunity to talk about topics that are uncomfortable and many do not want you to know about because it might change your opinion about what you have always believed, and you might decide on a different avenue. I know I will. This show was created to bring awareness to people about the dangers of enrolling their loved ones or themselves into hospice without knowing the facts and not the fiction that many hospice staff tell you. The fact is that hospice services were meant to be compassionate and helpful in the dying process at the end of someone's life. They were meant to minimize pain for the actively dying, not to drug a person into unconsciousness until they can't think, talk, eat, drink, or swallow, and ultimately it hastens their death with the drugs and dehydration, a horrible way to have the last chapter of your life executed. And yet, this is what is happening across the country. It was intended for people who had diseases that could no longer be treated with medication. However, hospice has tumbled down a slippery cliff, enrolling people who can be treated with medication, and they have diseases like congestive heart failure, COPD, or dementia. They're not terminal, and the fact is no one can predict when they will die, and certainly not within a six-month time frame. Today, the criteria has been watered down further to include people who might have difficulty dressing or eating or because they're incontinent. Or if someone goes to the hospital three or more times within 6 months, they're called a frequent flyer. Any of these can make you eligible for hospice. As many of you are probably aware, if you have a urinary tract infection, a UTI, they can cause confusion, lack of appetite, irritability, fatigue, decreased mobility, restlessness, and hallucinations, which could be the cause of many of the conditions that I mentioned a few minutes ago that would qualify you for hospice. And would a UTI mean death in 6 months? It can if it's not treated. And yet I hear often of patients that have UTIs that aren't being treated in hospitals, nursing homes, and hospices. What if the person was young? Would they be treated the same way? Probably not. But if a person is old, they are considered disposable. That's a fact. That's not my belief. It's happening all the time. And yet the elderly are not protected, but they are actually preyed upon and called for extinction. And we'll talk about that as we go through this. So what happens if you're a frequent flyer and you've been to the hospital three or more times in 6 months for COPD, breathing issues, broken bones? Anything can trigger that. It will get a call from a nearby hospice staff, and someone will show in to discuss with you how they can help you from having to go to the hospital or having to go visit your doctor's office. They can come to your home, they can provide meals, sitter services, and it won't cost you anything because Medicare and Medicaid will pay for it. Well, here's the catch. Once you enroll, you will be doomed because it has been determined you cost too much money and it's cheaper to drug you into a coma and hasten your death. They will conveniently stop giving you your regular medications, and they bring a comfort kit to your home, just in case you need it. They are great manipulators as they are trained how to deceive. Literally, this is what they do. It saves the government money. It pads the pockets of those who own these facilities and those who work there. And believe it or not, the hospice worker gets to add it to his or her quota. The hospital saves money because you won't be back to their facility for help. Michelle Young Duers provides detail on this in her book, Killing for Profit, The Dark Side of Hospice. She was a hospice respiratory therapist, and she saw the quotas and the treatment of hospital and hospice patients firsthand. I encourage you to check this book out for yourself. It's very informative, and it is a very easy read. It has lots of stories in it that shows you the compassion of hospice. And not all hospices are bad. Some are pro-life, and they treat the patient with dignity, which they should be, and they don't hasten the death. Sadly, we don't know about many. I'm aware of one in San Antonio, Texas. I think it's called Generous Home Care Management, but not others. I looked today online to see if I could find pro-life hospices. That doesn't seem like it'd be difficult to find, but I found two listed. One was San Antonio that I talked to you about, and the other one was in Kentucky. But that was back in 2005, and I could find nothing more on that one. Shouldn't they all be pro-life? The definition of a pro-life hospice is a program of care and support for people who are terminally ill. A physician must certify the patient is terminally ill with 6 months or less life expectancy if the disease takes its normal course. Two doctors are supposed to verify the patient meets hospice requirements. Typically now what is happening is the medical director of the hospice facility determines that the patient meets the criteria, and they've never even met the patient. The patient is not their patient, and they get to sign twice. How's that? And I think the definition needs to be much stronger than that for pro-life, just my opinion. At hospicepatients.org, Ron Panzer, who was also a hospice nurse, shares countless stories about what hospice has become. He has a book titled Stealth Euthanasia, Healthcare Tyranny that you can download from his site. It is a very informative site, and I encourage you to check it out as well. That's hospicepatients.org. Another very good site is halovoice.org, which now has a 24/7 helpline. If you have questions with your loved one in the facility or if you plan to put them there, they can answer your questions. That phone number is 888-221-HALO, H-A-L-O. The fact is, stealth euthanasia is happening right in front of us. It's under the radar because people have been told that hospice is compassionate. And by the time you realize that they're not, you are so in panic mode that you don't know what to do. And after your loved one dies, you are grieving and you feel like it's all my fault and you're racked with that guilt. The fact is that opioids and antipsychotics that they are giving our loved ones are causing them to die. Not the disease, but an overdose of the drugs, starvation, and dehydration. If you gave the same drugs that are given to our loved ones to a young, healthy person, the combination, the frequency, the duration, with starvation and dehydration, that person would die. So how is it that the loved one died from an incurable disease? They didn't. They died because they were overdosed, they were dehydrated, they were murdered. Personally, the reason that I do these shows and talk about it is because I personally witnessed my mother's murder in a hospice in Georgia in the summer of 2017. And I could not live with myself if I didn't warn people about it and tell them what happened to my mom. I am not alone. This is happening across the globe, and to my knowledge, every state in the United States. And now, with COVID, it's another way to call our elderly. Why do you think it is that they sent COVID-positive patients to a facility with the most vulnerable people, our elderly, who were in confined spaces? And yet, they released prisoners because they didn't want them to get it. They're in confined spaces, but it's okay to give it to our loved ones. And they didn't commit a crime. Their only crime was getting old. I don't know how people are not outraged at this. Our loved ones were not guilty, and they're gone. Tonight, our guest, Sarah Burns, talks about her dad, Jack Newsom. He was another victim of hospice during the COVID lockdown. He died on May the 23rd of this year. How convenient it is to get rid of our elderly in such an easy and vile way. A little bit about Jack Newsom. He and his wife, Joan, celebrated their 65th anniversary on August the 14th, 2019. But sadly, that would be the last they would ever celebrate. Furthermore, Jack Newsom would be denied his 88th birthday by 3 days as hospice staff would strike again on May the 23rd and end his life. Join me this evening in welcoming our guest, Sarah Burns, who will tell us about the last few months of her dad, Jack Newsom's life. You will hear how prior to his death, he would be abused by staff at the nursing home, but no one would acknowledge or stop the abuse, but would ramp the abuse up to death. Those complicit and responsible have no remorse for what they did or for the timing of it. They have no conscience, no morals, no compassion, and no heart. So, Sarah, I'd like to give you the opportunity to talk to us about your dad and let us know what happened.
Thank you, Marcia. First of all, I'm going to initially apologize for being all over the map. I'm going to try to keep this in some kind of order. But I'm still finding myself extremely emotional over my dad's death. And as you were mentioning about your own mom, I have a tremendous amount of guilt over it because I feel that my actions instigated him going into hospice. My dad, it was difficult. I live in California, and he was in a nursing facility called Dilworth in St. Louis. My mom lives in St. Louis. I have a sister who's a nurse, a retired nurse in St. Louis, who I refer to as Nurse Ratchet. And we have not seen eye to eye on the care of both of my parents. And part of that reason is because I myself have had 12 hip replacements. I've gone through numerous surgeries where I have been given massive amounts of painkillers after the surgery, which honestly I refuse after a day or two to take. Because my legs aren't strong, I have always been determined to keep my mind as strong as possible to keep going in this life. A little bit more about my own background. I carry a master's in social work. I have worked, I was in what was referred to as an LPN2 in Illinois, and that gave me the credential to give meds. And for about a year, I worked in a nursing home myself, dispensing medications. And it was an awful job because my day was just grinding up meds and putting it in applesauce and spoon feeding it to people that were so out of it that, you know, my thought was, you know, all these people really need is some wine and prune juice, and I think they'd be happy. So I've always been very aware of drug usage, especially in the elderly. And what I do now is I am not a social worker per se. I am what's considered a certified brain health coach. I trained with the Amen Clinic here in California. And I have my own practice, and I'm also an energy healer. So I blend the two together where I'm doing counseling under the title coaching and doing assessments for proper brain health for people. So before my dad even entered the nursing home, I was already a little upset with his care because it didn't seem like anybody was really diagnosing him properly. I had noticed in 2005, we went on a trip to Oregon, he and I, and I remember we were at the Rose Gardens there, and he was walking down a hill, and he said he couldn't stop his legs from walking. And that was a red flag for me because I had a friend here who had Parkinson's pretty severely, and he had that same issue. And I really encouraged him and my family at that point to get him to go get an assessment done to see if he actually did have Parkinson's. And through the years, I heard that he didn't necessarily have Parkinson's. And so I researched it more and more. And by the way, that information came from my sister. And I felt like his condition then could have been Parkinson's plus, which there are still things that you can do for that. But my sister took him to a migraine specialist who said that he had abraxis, not Parkinson's. And abraxis is when your limbs freeze. And I said, Cindy, that is a symptom of Parkinson's. So we had gone round and round and round about my dad having Parkinson's versus not having Parkinson's. And it wasn't until my dad's death that I received his death certificate where it stated that he died naturally of Parkinson's. And so part of what I've been dealing with is family members, particularly my sister, who, you know, is not being honest, not keeping us informed. She stated that she had the power of attorney over my dad's care, but she actually had the alternate power of attorney over his care. And my mom was never informed by nursing home staff of anything. Everything went through my sister. And my feeling to that, twofold. First of all, taking that power away from my mom and other things like I'll get into later, but I feel like that's contributed to my mom being controlled and dependent by my sister. But it also, my sister didn't share with us her intentions and knowledge of what the real reasons why my dad was going into hospice. So in all honesty, my dad was hard of hearing. And so it was really difficult for me to stay in good contact with him since I lived in California. All of the conversations that through the last 2 years, he entered this nursing home in 2017. He was wheelchair bound at that point, and he had problems getting to the bathroom, but he was still alert. He knew who everyone was. He read, he followed the news. He stayed as active with his mind as he possibly could. But our communications were dicey because he couldn't hear. And somehow he never had a device to where he could really talk to me except when my sister would call on his behalf. And so she would stand over the phone. So the conversation was her holding the phone and my dad basically saying to me quite frequently how he couldn't hear me and that he loved me. So those conversations became more and more infrequent because they were really frustrating to try to have the conversation. But when the COVID came about, the nursing home decided that they were going to allow residents speak to family members over Skype since no one could visit them in the facility. So I arranged for him on April 24th to have a Skype call with me. And prior to this phone call, the Sunday before, there was an incident that happened where my dad called my mom at the nurse's station and he was losing it and asked my mom to call the police because they had him tied up. And in the background, my mother could hear the staff laughing. Now, I don't know for sure if the staff was laughing specifically at my father or not, but what I do know is that there was no one there to calm my father down. And so my mother immediately called the police, and they went in and claimed they couldn't find anything wrong with him. And that may have been, you know, when I heard the story, I was like, well, that might have been possible. I don't know. I haven't talked to him in a while. But on April 24th, I was talking to him over Skype, and one of the first things I noticed was that on both of his forearms, on that outside bone, that there were multiple stages of bruising going on my father's arms. And on one of his wrists in particular, but kind of on both, I noticed that there was bruising wrapped around his wrist. And that, to me, was a huge red flag when I saw that. So in this video, my dad kept telling me he was being abused. And I kept trying to ask him what happened, And he wouldn't give me an answer. He just wanted it reported that he was being abused. And I was like, I want to understand how the bruising happened. And finally, the one thing my dad did say, because there was dementia involved, but one of the things he said to me very clearly, he pointed at the bruises and he said, I did not cause this. The other thing I noticed in that Skype call was that my father was very fearful. And my father was never a fearful person. He had been in this facility for a number of years, but he was fearful. He kept looking out at the door, looking afraid to speak. And so being a social worker myself, I was trained to look for abuse. And so the signs of abuse that I saw is I understood he had dementia, but he had marks on his body that did reflect potential abuse. He clearly stated he was being abused, and he also looked very fearful. And those things all together, to me, indicate abuse. Now, I had mentioned I used to work in a nursing home myself. And I recall when I worked in the nursing home that there were a few residents in the home that during report nursing staff was saying was acting out and being violent. And the residents in question there, they never were violent on my staff. There was one incident I got a little afraid with this guy with Alzheimer wandering down the hall. He had picked up a fire extinguisher, and he was kind of swinging it. And I was afraid, but I walked up to him, and I just said, hey, Ted, let's go for a walk. and let me hold that for you while we're walking. And that was the end of the issue. What I later discovered with these residents were they were, in fact, being tied down on other shifts because the nursing staff didn't want to be bothered with them. And this is what I have typically seen from that experience of my own, is that they just don't want to be bothered. They don't want to work too hard. And, yes, it's a hard environment to work in, but if you took the job, then do the job.
Right.
So, so when my dad told me all of this, when I got off of the phone, the first thing I did, and this is where the guilt comes in because I thought I was doing the right thing, I contacted Adult Protective Services in Missouri. And I spoke to a woman named Stacy. What is her name? Dornsife. In fact, I talked to her again today because when I was going through the records, I just got so angry that I demanded that she reopen the case, and she responded that they already did their investigation. That investigation, so that was on Tuesday, April 24th, that I had that conversation. And by Friday, that investigation was done. She claimed today that she had spoken to the person who had power of attorney and sample residents and reviewed the medical records and could not conclude that my father's actually had been abused. Well, I know that she didn't talk to my mother, who was the primary power of attorney. I suspect she talked to my sister, who kept trying to explain to me that she thought that Dad's arms were being bruised by hitting walls while he was moving the wheelchair. And I said, Cindy, there is no way if you're wheeling a wheelchair that your ulnar bone is going to be hitting the wall. It's going to be pointed down so the wheels can be moved, not the sides.
Can I say something?
Sure.
Okay. Let me just add for our listeners that the video that Sarah's talking about, I have seen the video. And in that video, she is correct. The bruises are around his wrist. They're not just like on one side or one the other.
Mm-mm.
They are around his wrist. Furthermore,
absolutely,
he is looking constantly to his right, like he's looking to the door, and he says, "Who's there? Who's there?" And Sarah lets him know there's nobody there. He's expecting somebody to come walk in and hear what he's saying to Sarah about it. He does point to his wrist and said, "I didn't do this. I didn't do this to myself." And when the nurse comes over to stop the call and say, "I have to go to another patient's office with Skype. We're going to have to end the call now," he said, "She's one of them. I thought she was my friend. She isn't." I mean, he is clearly, clearly afraid. And I'm not sure in your story where you're going to mention this, but about Kyle and the bathroom, because I believe that happened prior to the 24th.
Yes. So
Okay. Before
the Skype call, the other part of that, I talk to my mom virtually every day. And I heard this last fall, where my dad was really disturbed. He was in the restroom, and he had shared this with my mom, where he was being fondled in the restroom as they were cleaning him up. And he was really disturbed by it. Nothing happened from that. And honestly, because I was hearing it third party, I didn't do anything about it. You know, maybe I should have, but I didn't. And as I was thumbing through the medical records, there was, he had also mentioned that he was really afraid of a big black guy working there. And I have to tell you, my dad is not a prejudiced person. He fought for civil rights early on. This was not a prejudicial thing. But my dad was from the South, and my mom felt that the staff was prejudiced against him because of his Southern accent. And, you know, I wasn't there, but that's what my mom was sharing with me. But there, I read off to her when I got the medical records, all of the caregivers, and I said that there was a guy named Ryan. And she goes, oh, Ryan. No, he wasn't black, but Ryan went into his room one night and pulled up a chair and sat down and told your father all of the reasons why he hated him. And I'm like, now who in their right mind as a caregiver would do something as cruel as that? Because when you're in that situation, you depend on those people to be there to help you. And there's a thing, I trained in domestic violence, and it's called Stockholm Syndrome. And that is when you are feeling helpless and you have to befriend the people, the guards, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it's a very similar situation for people in nursing homes or even hospitals. I have felt like that, where you, as a patient, instead of worrying about your own needs, you're more concerned about pleasing the caregiver so that your needs do get met. And so I feel like that kind of conversation definitely needed to be investigated. And so he dealt with a lot of things there on an emotional level that I know added to him being angry, being frustrated. The administrator, and I'll get to that part in a moment, but said that my dad would pound his fist on the table. Well, my dad was always a patient person. And like I was talking about, when my experience working in nursing homes, my feeling is you have to push that person. I don't care how much dementia they're at. You have to push a person to act out. There is always some relevance to what they're saying and what they're believing and what they're doing. And so even though he's classified as having dementia, that dementia was pushed forward by the nursing staff. And I know I'm jumping ahead, because the reason that got validated was the day the hospice staff went in, which we think only was one day. I don't know that 100%, but nobody saw him after this one day. They had my dad singing "You Are My Sunshine." And I'm thinking, if this person is really at this level of dementia to be in hospice, then he wouldn't be singing "You Are My Sunshine" if there wasn't, you know. So it's how a person is being treated that's going to egg on those kinds of dementia in my mind. And I'm drawing that from my experience working in a nursing home, drawing from my training in looking for abuse. These things don't just show up because a person has dementia. Something has to instigate it for the person. So anyway, what happened was this APS investigation concluded on a Friday, the 27th, and my mom called me late in the afternoon telling me that my sister was going to come over with a hospice nurse because they're going to put dad on hospice. This all happened at the same time. So then on April 30th, which I guess was a Monday, the contract for hospice was signed. My sister met the hospice nurse over at my mom's assisted living apartment and to sign off these papers. And in the meantime, I got a call directly from the administrator of Dilworth, Mark Jeffries. And I was kind of surprised he called me, even though I did request that, but he waited until after this APS investigation to give me a call. And he shared with me that because of my dad being isolated and his dementia was getting worse, that they felt it would be for his good mental health to put him on hospice so that the COVID-19 policy could be bypassed and my mother can go in and visit him. So I'm like, okay, well, that's good. And in that same conversation with him, though, I did say, look, my dad is afraid of the staff there, and he does have bruising. And I know that my dad isn't just saying that off of the top of his head. There has got to be an element of truth to what my dad is saying. And that just kind of went right over his head. There was no discussion that he was going to do any kind of an investigation, nothing.
That's criminal.
So it's criminal. And it's still something that I do want investigated. As I was telling you, Marcia, they have stalled on giving me the medical records. It took me over 30 days to get a partial set of records, but I found out, I kept saying there's things missing here because I used to be a nurse, and I'm like, there's things seriously missing from this. 272 pages of their own notes and 26 hospice pages were accidentally not turned over to me. And they're asking for another $90. And so I'm refusing that. And I did file with HIPAA over this because, you know, one of the things about it that's so disturbing is that I'm trying to understand in full my father's death, and that in itself, not getting those records, is torment for me.
You're right, it is.
It's abusive. And I did tell them that if they don't give it to me, which I think I am anyway, but I want to get an attorney if possible, and I don't know what my chances are, but I'm trying to put everything as articulately together so that I can get somebody's attention so this looks as black and white as it needs to appear so that it's easily reviewed legally.
So let me step back a second. Can I step you? Okay. So when your sister and the hospice person went to see your mom in assisted living, what did they say to your mom to get your mom to sign the papers that she could see him twice a week because of COVID?
Right. Well, that's all my mother was told. That's
so
all
not
my
because
mother...
he met any criteria for becoming a hospice patient, but because of COVID, they would put him into hospice. So that to me meant he did not meet criteria for hospice. And hospice had volunteered, and there's been several articles out, and there's a group called Voices for Seniors, over 3,000 people in the Facebook group, and they have they're trying to get some type of justice because a lot of them are from New York City and their loved ones were murdered under the COVID thing. But hospice volunteered to come in and help because they are familiar with dying people. And so they were so nice to come in and help. I am willing to bet that the majority of those people that died from, in quote, COVID, that you would find that they have high doses of morphine, lorazepam, or Ativan in their system, just as your dad did. They didn't die from COVID. They died because they were euthanized because they didn't want to deal with them.
Absolutely. I would agree with you on that. I'm sure of it. So, you know, when my dad went into hospice, I really didn't know criteria. You know, I used to do case management, so I think that did help me along after his death. But I realized when I got the records, and I will say the Hospice Alliance, big help for me, gave me a lot of directions to look at things. And the one thing that really jumped out initially to me was that in order to meet Medicare criteria for hospice, you have to be at what's called the functional, assessment test or whatever. It's basically a scale to determine what your dementia level is. And what was really telling about that for me was that in that level, it has to be at level 7. Big part of it is the speech has to decline to about a half a dozen intelligible words. My dad had no problem talking. On that, you saw on the video on April 24th,
right.
He knew who I was. He was having a conversation with me, maybe not answering my questions, but boy, he was talking. And it wasn't just 6 words he was saying. And I did go through the records again today. There was an incident report where they found him 2 weeks before this. I guess he tried to climb out of the bed, but they found him sitting on the floor, not laying on the floor, but sitting on the floor at the side of his bed looking for his socks. So he was able to sit up. So that was another
right.
thing that didn't meet that level 7 criteria. So you ask about my sister, and I am going to just say something about that too, because at the time of my dad, you know, when I had the conversation 2 days before he died, I asked her if they had put him on more meds, because it was obvious to me that he was drugged up. He couldn't barely keep his eyes open, and he didn't know who I was initially. And she claimed that they had not. And I asked about it again when he died, and she said she went into this long, dishonest discourse about no, they had not put him on anything more. Well, she must have known, and I'll get into that a little bit more later, but I want to kind of stay on track here. My mom believed he was going on hospice so that she could visit him twice a week. One of those days, by the way, I didn't share this with you before, that first week, apparently they had they wanted her to come in, I forget what days, Monday and Thursday, I believe, and they had a 2-hour window of time for her to visit, and she's forgetful too, but she went in at the wrong time, and this administrator called the police on my mom and claimed that my mom snuck in to see my dad. And she didn't. She had actually signed in at the desk to go in. And I'm thinking, my God, the woman, I forget her age. She told me again today, it's 86. I'm like, you called the police on an 86-year-old woman who wants to see her husband that now is in hospice.
That's
that makes
ridiculous.
No sense. Totally absurd. And of course she left there feeling anxious and scared herself angry. And so, you know, I had to have a conversation with this guy, and I just said, you know, is there a real reason? You know, maybe the time limit thing, but does it matter what time really she goes in to visit my dad? I mean, he's not going anywhere. And he goes, well, I guess we can slide that a little.
Can you imagine her showing up in court and the her what is the crime? She showed up at the facility to see her husband who was on hospice, and she came
right
at the wrong time. Are you kidding me?
Are you
see, this is
me
the way that we treat our elderly, disrespectfully,
right,
because your mother was probably very upset. I mean, she could have gotten in her car and had a wreck on the way home because she was so distraught by being
right
disrespected like that.
And
she's probably never been arrested before, and have a police show up. That's crazy.
Well, and after my dad's death, you know, she has slidden. And one of them was she went over to Dilworth to check on the medical records, and she got lost. She got 30 miles out of St. Louis. And I know the reason is because she's so triggered by this place. So through the last, starting in January, she was asking me, please help me find him a new place. And I'm like, I'm in California. I did line my mom up with a medical, not a medical, but a social worker there because of the issues she's having with my sister in meds, and that's a whole other conversation. But my mom is on 14 different medications, and that's just way too many. That's a whole other thing. But the thing is, she doesn't get along with my sister. My sister is gung-ho 2 months after my dad's death to take her car away and is pushing herself to go into a nursing home. So I have a lot going on with my mom at this point. And so I am my mom's sounding board. And so I do stay in contact with her every day, and I am having her come out here in a couple of weeks so that she can have some healing done herself. But the thing is, this nursing home, that calling the police to me kind of shows how they treat the residents there as well.
There's no doubt.
Doing that, yeah, if you're doing that to the visitors, then what are you doing to the residents? So anyway, every time my mom went in to see him before the COVID thing, Dad was begging for her to get him out of there. And she was going to the administrator of her assisted living for help. She talked to the social worker. I talked to the social worker. And there's just no way that anybody wanted to make an effort to get my dad out. And I don't think he could because he was on Medicare and Medicaid. So he was pretty well trapped in there. So I want to move on. So anyway, so she
outside
on April,
with the COVID made everything more difficult because they were keeping patients there. But outside of that, if, because you don't live there, but your sister could have gone there, driven up, and removed him from that facility if she had somewhere else to put him. She could have done that. So there are
she
ways.
Didn't want
I don't want
to.
Yeah, I don't want the listeners to think that if your loved one is in a facility, you don't have any choice. Yes, you do.
Right.
This COVID has made it much worse, and it would take effort. But, yes, you can get somebody out of a facility that you do not feel like they're safe in and that they're being abused, sexually molested, emotionally abused, or physically abused, which, sadly, your father was all three of those. But you can get your loved one out. COVID has made it more difficult, but you can get your loved ones out of those facilities. So I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sarah.
No, you're right. The problem in this case was my sister, her response to my mom always was the care was adequate. And I just want to, this is a personal thing, but I think the reason my sister was perfectly fine with everything is she was a retired nurse. And I truly believe, first of all, she wasn't the power of attorney, but they were calling her. So it kind of fed her ego as being a nurse still. And I And I said this to her, when I found out what happened to my dad, they blew sunshine up your, and that's why you ignored everything that dad was trying to say, because you got to play Nurse Nancy again in this nursing home. And so I truly believe that, you know, the fact that she would go in and they were extremely kind to her, but my mom just, I'm sorry, my sister just downplayed what my mom was trying to say and what my father was trying to say through that whole thing. So it is a situation where there's people, they were both feeling powerless. And that, so, you know, I'm powerless because I am not the power of attorney for my mom. And I'm not sure that could ever happen. We're going to talk about it, but it may be really challenging for me at this point. So that's something I have to kind of look at when my mom comes to visit. But anyway, my dad's diagnosis when he went into hospice was Parkinson's with weight loss and debility. He had quite a few other diagnoses at the initial hospice diagnosis, but the one that in particular that really jumped out at me is that my dad had had obstructive sleep apnea for years. And when I visited him in the nursing home, he used to have a CPAP that he used, and he didn't have it at this nursing home facility. So to me, that's a question, because here they are putting him on this combination of opioids and benzodiazepines, which they firmly believe that you do not give this to people with sleep apnea. It will cause death. So what did hospice do? He got signed up on April 30th. Immediately on April 30th, there was a PRN order where he was placed on lorazepam and morphine, PRN, meaning whenever needed. So that was the very first day he signed up. And so on May 1st, I was looking at, did he take them? So on May 1st, they gave my dad lorazepam. On May 2nd, they gave him morphine, but they didn't combine them together. Now, that was a weekend. On May 4th, which was a Monday, there was a telephone order by his doctor to where he could take morphine and lorazepam, not PRN, but he needed it twice a day at 8 and 4 p.m. The reason...
Go ahead.
Well, the reason they gave him the morphine, it was indicated for pain and difficult breathing. And the lorazepam was for restlessness. It was called terminal restlessness, as needed for anxiety. Now, this doctor did not come in face-to-face to see my father. He hadn't seen my father since February. He was basing this telephone order on what a nurse was telling him. The other thing I forgot to mention is, and I told this to the administrator when they were talking about hospice, is I did say to him, my father needs a psych eval. He has anxiety and he does need to be evaluated. They never did that. Never. And that came up again, especially today, that really hit me hard when I was going through his med record, because some of the combinations of meds that he was taking, it could have reduced some of the dementia he was having. But when I saw the indication for pain and dyspnea, I'm like, God, in that conversation I had, he not once mentioned pain to me. Not a single time. And so it's been on my mind. Did he have more pain? So today I decided to go back through his medical records and take a look at the meds for the last 3 months. And it was very interesting to me. Because in March, he was also on an opiate, a synthetic opiate called Tramadol. He'd been on that for a long time. He was taking 200 milligrams of that a day, and he could take up to 300 milligrams. That's the normal dose. So I found it interesting that they didn't increase the Tramadol another 50 milligrams or whatever, but instead decided to put him on the morphine and lorazepam. But he had a PR in order for this Tramadol, and in March he took it one time, and on 14 days he took 650 milligrams of Tylenol and one 1,000 milligram of Tylenol in March. In April, he took no extra Tramadol. He took 8 650 milligrams of Tylenol and 3 1,000 milligrams of Tylenol. He took Tylenol twice on April 10th. So he wasn't taking this stuff a bunch. And that's not even a half a month of taking extra pain meds. And then when May rolled around, they gave him no Tramadol, no Tylenol. Instead, they started with lorazepam, and then on the 2nd, the morphine. Morphine on May 5th, May 6th, more morphine on May 7th, lorazepam May 9th, and then no more until the last 2 days of his life, they gave him an extra dose of morphine each day. And you saw the video, the last conversation I had. Did this look like a man that needed more morphine?
No, it did not. He looked like he was quite in la-la land. He couldn't keep his eyes open, and he was having a very difficult time talking, and he could
Absolutely.
Not concentrate. Right.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention to the listeners, mm-hmm. when you're talking about the morphine and the lorazepam
mm-hmm.
is the same thing as Ativan.
Right.
A lot of the people have heard about morphine and Ativan,
mm-hmm.
and the nurses have joked about, if you don't do what I want you to do, I'll give you a ham sandwich, which is Haldol, Ativan, and morphine. So
it is
a joke amongst them about giving those drugs to the patients, and it wouldn't surprise me that they were laughing in the background when he was talking to your mom about
mm-hmm.
being tied up. The other thing
mm-hmm.
that I wanted to point out is when you were talking about on May the 1st, now,
mm-hmm.
prior to him being on hospice, he was in the nursing home. Once he went
mm-hmm.
to hospice, which was the 30th of April, and then you
mm-hmm.
talked about on May the 1st, which would be on the
mm-hmm.
weekend. Then he got the morphine. Then he got the Ativan the following day. Then on
mm-hmm.
Monday, the order went in no longer as needed. He no longer was going to get Tramadol or the Tylenol because he's now in hospice. And hospice
nope.
is in to ramp it up. And when
right.
the nurse came in, during the weekend, they have different staff
mm-hmm.
that are there. They don't make the
mm-hmm.
decisions. When
mm-hmm.
the head nurse came in on Monday, then
mm-hmm.
she came in, made the decisions. The doctor didn't have to make the decisions. The nurse came
mm-hmm.
in and decided, we're ramping it up. We're going to
mm-hmm.
give this twice a day, and the
mm-hmm.
doctor will go along. And
mm-hmm.
you saying that, it's interesting, and I'm not going to turn this about my mom, but it's interesting
no.
when you
okay.
said that to me, it triggered
mm-hmm.
because my mom went in on a Friday night for respite care for my dad to recover because he was her care provider. And on that Monday morning, when the nurse came in, the head nurse, she increased her fentanyl to 100 micrograms,
mm.
changed her from respite care to end-of-life palliative
mm.
care, and gave her morphine and Ativan and fentanyl.
Mm.
They said, and she had been earlier on oxycodone, hydrocodone, before, and that's what she was taking for pain for her hip, but they changed it to morphine by telling her, your medication is making you constipated, so that's why we're going to change it to morphine, which, as a nurse, you know that morphine causes constipation. Correct, probably more so than the hydrocodone would cause. But it's interesting you say that because it triggered when you said that, because the reason that they did not give as much was when the head nurse came in on Monday morning, she made the decision to start ramping up how much they were going to give your dad. She didn't need the tramadol, the Tylenol, because it wasn't about keeping your dad comfortable. It was about hastening his death.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, let me just point this out. They didn't remove the tramadol, okay? They were still giving that tramadol to my dad four times a day. He was
And then they gave him the morphine and the Ativan.
And the lorazepam. Ativan, lorazepam. Yes. He was getting that. And so here's some things that I was looking at today. I didn't have time to go through all his meds. But the thing he was also on, the things that jumped out, there were a couple of meds that I'm like, if somebody really did an eval on my dad, they would have taken him off some of these things. So he was on tramadol, been on it for a long time, 50 milligrams four times a day. He could take a PRN dose of 50 milligrams if he wanted. So the logical thing would have been, you know, I'm guessing as an ex-nurse, would have been, okay, if his pain med isn't working, let's increase it. He's tolerated the tramadol, let's increase it to 300 milligrams a day. That would have been the logical thing because he's already at that level of toleration. But instead, they add the morphine and the lorazepam. Well, he was also on Lexapro. And this is the stuff that I just get so... That's what I do for work. I help people. I can't legally tell them to taper down. Usually when people come to me, they've already made that decision. And I always tell people, you know, you need to do that under a doctor's care. So I'm very clear about that. But what I know about taking antidepressants is that usually some people say within 6 weeks and some people say within 2 years that they lose their effectiveness. And some of the things that antidepressants can do is there's a thing called cardiodyskinesia, which can cause you to have tremors. It can cause you to shake. It can cause you to twitch. Your eyes will blink. And people don't know. So when you're getting off of those kinds of things in particular, all of those symptoms ramp up for you. And that's why I do the energy work. It helps to balance that and move that energy out so they're not as terrible symptoms. But what happens? So he's on Lexapro, which is called an SSRI, and there is a condition called serotonin syndrome. And what the symptoms are, and there's many, but the ones that I feel related to my father is confusion, hallucinations, muscle spasms, stiffness, tremors, incoordination, and in some cases, coma and death. And I'm going to look for, give me 1 second here, because I ran across, that was when you mix tramadol with Lexapro, that causes that condition. So my dad was on both of those for a long time. The other thing is they put him on another drug called Xanaflex. And I believe that too is an opioid. And it's used to relax muscle spasms. Oh, no, it's a benzodiazepine. So and like, okay, so he's taking these two meds for years and getting stiffness and tremors and muscle spasms, and then you're going to add another benzo to the mix to help him with the muscle spasms. So if somebody was a real good, you know, really thorough looking at all of those three meds alone, there may have been a chance that they could have started tapering off of the Lexapro, for example. And maybe what would have followed suit is some of these other things he was taking, he might not have needed as much as well. But instead, what they ended up doing is adding more opioids, the morphine, along with the lorazepam. So taking all those together, you know, all he could do was die.
Yes. Absolutely.
That's it.
Now, was he taking the benzodiazepine before he was in hospice?
Yes.
Okay, so the doctor had him taking those three drugs.
Yep. And they didn't
Well,
quit.
And see, they should have evaluated that. And this is the thing that many of us are starting to realize. The drugs that we're taking, that being prescribed for us, are so highly dangerous.
Oh,
and
my
I'm not
God.
Saying that Parkinson's doesn't need to be treated with drugs, and I'm not a doctor.
No.
I'm not saying that. But you need to reevaluate and see if there's something out there that can be used that can help, or maybe there are new things, or maybe something natural, or maybe changing the diet, or lessening the amounts of something instead of just adding, well, let's try this, let's try this, well, let's add this on. And then in the facility, once hospice came on board, and they knew he would, typically they will stop, your blood pressure medicine, your, anti-kidney medicine, or whatever you're taking. Most of them will eventually, I know with my mom, she couldn't eat or drink or swallow, so she stopped all of her heart medication because the point here is that person is going to die and they are going to make it happen. So they did not care. And your mom said, and I know you're probably going to get to this, but it makes me think of this now, that it looked like that your dad had bird seed on his lips.
Yes.
Because they were forcing him to take medication. He couldn't swallow anymore, and they were forcing that medication down him to make sure that they did the deed. I'm sorry, but our loved ones. That is plain and simple. And if anybody cared, and if anybody looked at those records and that investigation that they did for you and all of the drugs, any rational person would look at that and would say, yes, we have a calling going on across the country. We are killing our elderly. We are killing babies before they're born. And we are killing our elderly before it's time for them to die, because we are playing God and making that decision. And it is a crime. It is wrong in every
it
sense of the word.
Absolutely. They are not, there are laws against euthanizing people, but that's exactly what they're doing. And so you mentioned, like, the bird seed. One thing I just wanted to interject about meds, because this might be helpful for some people. I told you my sister and I don't see eye to eye, and my mom has diabetes. And when I went to visit them for their 65th wedding anniversary, my sister came over, and she was just yelling at my mom for not taking all of her meds. And I took photos of everything my mom was taking. She was taking 14 different kinds of medication. And I went through each and every one of them, and there were many contradicting one after another. And I did a lot of research for this last year for my mom, to where the Geriatric Society says that elderly people should only be on 3 burden medications maximum. Now, there was another place in Texas, and I believe it was through Baylor, where they felt that if and it's called polypharmacology. And their belief was that if you were taking, and not just prescribed medications, but this includes over-the-counter, along with all these other things that are prescribed, if you're taking 9 or more, then that is considered a severe level of intake of drugs. And that's, you know, I counted up today, my dad was on 17 different things. You know, some of them sounded innocuous, but the truth is, you know, he didn't need 17 different medications. He just didn't. And that was before they added the morphine and lorazepam. They didn't take him off of any of it, by the way. He still was getting all of it. So I had talked to him on the 23rd. He didn't know who I was at first in the conversation, and he was groggy. He wanted to go to bed. He was thirsty. And then finally, at the end of that conversation, he goes, "I do recognize you." And that was pretty much the end of the conversation that I had had with my dad. And then I went to work Saturday morning, and my mom called before my client came to tell me he had just died. And it was, I have to tell you, I didn't share this with you, but the whole week I kept seeing this crow. And I just felt like, oh, I know what's going to happen. I know what's going to happen. And when I pulled back home, I had to come home. There was a crow sitting in my parking space, basically, just sitting there.
Oh, and then Sarah.
Yeah. And I didn't feel like it was evil. I felt like the crow was actually feeling sorry for me for what had happened. And so it was really painful for me because I had told my mom the day before, I said, "Mom, you need to get a hold of those hospice nurses because they're over-medicating him." And she said, "Sarah, I have not seen those hospice nurses except for the first day I went in there, the very start of this." So I have, it was, they just did the hospice care in the nursing home. And I have no idea if they were actually going in. She never saw them again. I think that was just kind of a front for them to drug up my dad. But my mom told me later that day, she said, "Sarah, you know, and like you shared already, she said, it looked like he had bird seeds in his mouth. And the morphine was being given sublingually. So I suspect, in looking at that PRN order, that they gave him extra morphine in the night. I don't know because I don't have the times. I don't have why they even gave him the morphine. That's what I'm trying to find out now. But I suspect that he was so dehydrated that it couldn't even dissolve in his mouth. But he was chain stoking that morning when they called my mom, and my sister and my brother went in. And this nurse had the audacity to come in and ask if he needed more morphine.
Oh, and my God.
I'm like, my God, he's already dying. I mean, you know, I couldn't believe what my mom was telling me. And my sister had told me that he wasn't taking any of this stuff. And I said, "Cindy, it sounds like Dad was taking morphine." And she goes, "Oh, no, Sarah, he wasn't. The nurse came in to see if maybe we should get an order for morphine." Now, this is a Saturday morning. He's chain stoking. They don't have an on-site pharmacy. So her story wasn't making sense to me at that point. And sure enough, when I got the medical records, there it was. So I said, I really let her have it. And I don't know if we'll ever talk again. And honestly, I don't think I can talk to her again. I don't feel I can trust her. For her to lie. And I finally said, if you knew, did you know he was on morphine and lorazepam? She didn't respond. I said, you know what? I'm going to take the fact that you're not responding that yes, you did know. And you just chose not to discuss that with anybody else in the family, particularly mom, dad, me, my two brothers. The problem was my brothers, when I raised this, you know, question and concern, I actually sent them documents showing how this can kill. And this blew me away, too. My brother said, Sarah, leave it alone. He was just old.
That's not an excuse.
It's not an excuse. And, you know, it's time to die. And I have this belief. I really believe that we have a time we're born and we have a time to die. We don't push that along. And there's a reason for it. There's, on a spiritual level, there's reasons for why things happen the way that they do. And it's not our business to be playing God. And this is the thing that, you know, looking at a lot of the information your, you know, Ron's organization had out and looking at some of the stuff on murder by hospice, it just, I don't know what's wrong with people where we've gotten to this place where we can justify harming our elders or anyone. And I guess the other reason I take heart to it is I told you, I've had 12 hip replacements. And I walk with a cane. Does that make me expendable? Are we going to start?
As long as you don't go to the hospital a couple of times.
Exactly.
But, and you're not, I mean, you're not old. But
no.
It doesn't. The disabled and the elderly are being called, and they are making the decision what is a healthy life and who is viable and who is not, and what
exactly
will become the new old, 70?
Right. Right.
You know, 80? What will they decide that we need to knock off people because they don't deserve to breathe the air anymore? They've lived long enough. They're costing money. And I'll be honest with you, I will not go to the hospital because I'm afraid if I go that I might not come out of there. So God help me if I get sick or something, because I'm not going.
Well, I understand that because I've been a nurse and I've worked in hospitals. They're just human beings. And I have to tell you, every time I went through a surgery, terrified I would die. Terrified because I saw the human mistakes that constantly get made in hospitals. I also saw the behavior of nurses, and I don't want to criticize each and every nurse out there, but there is this arrogance. There is this, they're know-it-alls, many of them. They think they know everything about everybody. They don't let other people do their jobs. I remember when I worked in med-surg, how the nurses would go in the room, you know, in the back room and roll their eyes if a patient wasn't meeting the time frame for when they needed to leave the hospital. They were crazy. They were making it up. They're drama queens. I've seen it on both sides. So I know exactly how people operate in these facilities. And you should be afraid. You should be.
Right.
And
I was talking earlier about the book by Michelle Young Doers, and she tells stories in there exactly what you're saying in her book, Killing for Profit, because the nurses don't care, and they don't know everything, and
they don't
make decisions based upon inaccurate information or like, oh, well, I know how to do this. No, you don't.
Exactly.
And
well,
it seems to me the nurses are making the decisions for the doctors in hospice, at least.
Right.
Because the hospice doctors are not, you know, I know with Mom, I never saw her regular doctor that was there. The only one I saw was the one that came in on the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of the time, I never saw the other doctor. And supposedly,
mm-mm,
per the medical records, he saw her. He was there every single day.
Hmm.
We were there 24/7. We stayed in the room with her.
Mm-hmm.
I had my two dogs with me in a playpen.
Mm-hmm.
We stayed in that room and slept on a chair together, just sitting straight up, because
mm-hmm,
we wouldn't leave her. The doctor did not come in every day. That is a lie.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I want to come back to and mention,
mm-hmm,
you paid, so the listeners understand, you paid $90 for incomplete records.
Yes.
And when you called them back to let them know that there were records missing, days missing, they wanted another $90.
Yes.
And they were very rude to you. And
yes,
they just don't want to be bothered with you because you're
right,
asking them for information they don't want to give you, because the fact
right
is they murdered your dad.
Yes.
And they want you just to let it go. Just let it go.
Yes.
And
I
your
know
sister, sounds like, she wants you to just let it go because
of course
he was 87. My God, they
right
took away his right to have his 88th birthday. 3 days before he turns 88, they
mm-hmm
murdered him. And that is something that you and your mom, every year, you know, you'll think about it.
It will. And the big part about this, okay, to me, with her withholding that information, the big part about it is it didn't allow the rest of us to have closure with my dad. Had I known what was going on or what the intention, and she knew, she worked in oncology, by the way, so she knew. Okay, I could have gotten on a plane to be with my dad.
Mm-hmm.
She took that away from me. She took it away from my dad to get final closure in his life with all of us.
Exactly.
She robbed my mother of having that final preparedness and closure. It didn't have to go this way. So it was
no
very arrogant of her to just make that decision and withhold that information from the rest of the family. And she's very controlling, and that's the thing I notice about nurses. They're very controlling people. They know everything. And I know I sound awful about it, but I've worked in the medical environment. I told you, Marcia, I started being a patient when I was 2 years old. I worked as a nurse's aide. I worked in the emergency room as a receptionist. I've worked as a medical office manager. I've worked as a medical social worker. I was insurance. I know the hospital system like the back of my hand, and I want it out of it so bad. And that's why I went to school to do social work, so I could do more counseling than be in that environment again. First job I had out of school was medical social work. I was so frustrated because, as I was telling you, these nurses would walk up to me asking for phone numbers to agencies. And, you know, I didn't know why it wasn't. I would give them a phone number. I'd go in a patient's room to make a discharge plan, and they would be gone because the nurse gave them a phone number. Now, these nurses had no idea if these agencies were taking people, what the criteria was for taking them, if there may have been a better solution out there. They just did it because, again, they think they know everything. And I, on another level, I went to school for many years, and here these girls, you know, they go for 2 years, and they're making $30,000 more than me. And I'm thinking, I don't quite understand that. I don't understand that at all. And I think that that, too, contributes to some of this, you know, arrogance on their part, because there is this hierarchy in the hospital. And the minute you're at that RN status, man, you're right next to God. But the truth is, the doctor is still God. And this is a thing that I noticed. You know, I spent a week trying to find this law because this doctor didn't go in and do a face-to-face assessment on my dad. He hadn't seen him since February. And, in fact, those notes said my dad was improving. And he's doing a phone order for these things. And the law is no. Now, if it was after that six-month period for Medicare and they're still alive, then, yes, the doctor has to do a face-to-face assessment, but not before.
Well, that's the recertification point at that.
Right. But
You were talking about that we have 3 minutes left. You were talking about the nurses being arrogant in some of the things they were doing. There is a Facebook group that is called Oh Hell, I'm a Hospice Nurse. And on that group, they actually joke about being a hospice nurse, and they show pictures, and they think it's funny, just like you've seen the different things with people abusing people in the nursing home, and they get some kind of sick humor out of this. And I believe some of them who are in the hospice facilities are serial killers, and they think they're angels of mercy, and it's just disgusting.
It is.
With the time that we have left, is there anything you would like to add to your story to let our listeners know? Any warnings?
Well, I think I pretty well covered everything. The one thing what I was going to say is I do think some of these laws need to be changed, and I don't know how that can get formed. But the big one is, even though it's still like a rubber stamp thing, I do feel that doctors still need to do the face-to-face evaluation before they start giving all these orders for killing a person. And if they are going to allow that, then I think that nurses should be held just as liable for malpractice as a doctor for making those determinations.
That is absolutely true.
Yeah, and I don't know how to get that rolling, but to me, I think that that's a really big one because I think that healthcare is starting to, you know, just dwindle down, and all of that is because these nurses have pushed for taking on more responsibility, but they don't want to be held accountable. And that's what
I think they all should be in the medical profession. They should all be held accountable. And hospice needs to be completely revamped. This Friday, Marty Kaz, Mary, and I will be talking about some different hospice regulations and rules.
Okay.
We just did a whistleblower summit a couple of weeks ago. And we will be having a talk show this Friday, and we will be discussing some of those new legislative laws that may or may not be helpful. And I think a lot of times we're told one thing that is not actually the truth, but we will be discussing that on Friday. So hopefully our listeners can join us this Friday. And thank you so much, Sarah, and I am so sorry again. I know how hard this is for you, and it's just been so recent, May the 23rd of this year.
Yes, and I want to thank you, too, because, you know, my family cut me off and even being concerned except my mother, and I just want to thank you for giving me the time to share all of this because on one level it's really helped my own healing, but... You know, I appreciate this group. I'm glad it's there because I think many more people really need the support. They just do. So thank you, Marcia. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're absolutely welcome, Sarah. And as most of my guests will tell you, our journey doesn't end here. I am still available for you. We will still talk.
Thank you.
And, you know, if you need to work something out, you and I are in it for life. So this is not the end.
Yeah. And if there's anything I can do as well to help support getting some of these laws changed, you definitely reach out to me, and I'll do what I can. Okay?
I absolutely will. I will. And thank you to all of our listeners tonight for calling in. We appreciate you calling in and giving us support. And if you have anything to say, you can always include that on Marty's website, Talk Show Radio. Thank you very much, everybody. Good night.
Good night.